The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Saving lives at all costs now faces the economic side of the equation as fears from desperate workers and business owners grow louder.
My view is this. If the government is going to take these health measures that force people out of work, that we need to take comparable measures to keep the jobs that people have.
Are our government and law enforcement overreaching?
I'm willing to give the cops themselves who are getting these orders a little bit of wiggle room, puts them in a very hard spot.
Plus, evidence piles up that the World Health Organization has been parroting China's lies.
The WHO has been repeating every single step of the way the narratives of the Chinese Communist Party, including their lies on top of lies.
And Senator Cotton sticks to his early caution that the labs in Wuhan could be the source of the virus.
China has a history of bad laboratory construction and practices, and surely the Chinese officials knew about these concerns as well, yet they apparently did not do much to try to remedy them.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com, and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. As the health crisis seems to be leveling out in parts of the country, deep concerns grow about the toll on the economy. The predicted hospital crisis has been averted in most cities. During the 3 weeks ending April 15th, unemployment claims hit record highs, and news of a second wave of layoffs is spreading. Congress is seeking to ease this tragedy. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley is out with a big and bold plan that he claims would get everyone rehired. I think it could be a big help to an America facing some very stark economic realities. Senator Hawley joined my program early this week. I think Donald Trump is doing a fine job. I wrote it up in the Washington Post today. But mostly the example of Churchill is try everything, break the glass, pull the alarm, put Lord Beaverbrook in charge of aircraft production because he doesn't know anything about airplanes, but he's a hell of a leader. And that's why I turned to you. You broke the glass and you came up with a proposal that first I'd like you to lay out, then I'd like to explore with you. It is not in any way, shape, or form conservative, but I think it is urgently worthy of consideration.
Well, listen, we are in an unprecedented time, and this is a health pandemic like we've never seen in this country. Closest analog is 100 years ago with the 1918 influenza. We've never seen an economic, I hesitate to use the word collapse, because this is being induced. There's nothing wrong with the underlying economy, but the government, we've never had the government take measures like this to fight a health pandemic like this that is shutting down large swaths of our economy. And, you know, we are facing a true crisis, Hugh. And so my view is this, that if the government, in order to fight this pandemic, if the government is going to take these health measures that force people out of work and force them home from jobs, which may well be necessary to beat this thing, then we need to take comparable measures to keep the jobs that people have, to keep their employment, to keep them attached to their ability to earn a wage and support their families through the duration of the crisis. And that's why I have proposed a payroll tax rebate that would allow employers to rehire every person who has been laid off because of the pandemic, and for businesses who are having to shut down, for folks who are having to go without work because of this pandemic, this same program would cover 80% of employers' wages, 80% across the country for every business that's been affected. That would allow us to maintain employment. It would allow employees to retain their jobs, support their families, and then be in a position to surge strong once the economy reopens.
Now, Senator Hawley, I am familiar with the payroll protection program because the Nixon Foundation, which I also lead, Took advantage of it, went in, made our application to our community bank. They gave us our 2 months payroll or 250% of payroll. I don't have to lay anybody else off. It's wonderful. It worked for a small business. How is your proposal different from the payroll protection plan, the extension of which or the refunding of which was blocked last week by Democrats in the Senate? I can't believe they did it, but they did it. How does Hawley's proposal build on the McConnell proposal?
Yeah, and shamefully blocked. May I just add, Hugh, to your point? I mean, this program has been a desperately needed lifeline. The payroll protection plan covers a number of things, Hugh, beyond just payroll, which can be a strength for small business. You can use it for rent. You can use it for utilities. You can use it for mortgage. What my plan would do is it's bigger, it's bolder, and it's more direct. And in terms of it says it will cover every employee in America. We want to make sure that every person who is affected, no matter who they work for, where they work, is able to get their wage, is able to keep their job. And so, number one, my plan would try to rehire every person who has been laid off because of COVID-19. It would give business incentive. It would give them a bonus, as it were, to rehire every single person, number one. Number two, it would cover every wage up to the median at 80%. But for any business that has been affected, no matter where the business is, no matter the size, again, to try to preserve the job. This is a worker-focused plan. And then for the existing small business grant, oh, by the way, Hugh, let me just also say, it's a direct payment to the employer. So it flows through the employer to the employee. You don't have to apply for grants or loans. It's direct. The government advances those payments directly. So it's faster, hopefully, and it can last for the duration of the crisis, which we hope won't be long. But as long as is necessary. The other thing I would say, Hugh, is that as it relates to the small business loans, those can be used then for small businesses to pay their rent, to pay their mortgages, to pay their utilities, to help replace lost revenue. My plan is designed to focus on wages.
Over this past week, we've seen several news reports pointing to law enforcement's heavy hand. We saw intimidated churchgoers, with Kentucky's governor allegedly taking license plate numbers of those who attended drive-in worship services. City and county governments repeatedly encouraged snitching to discourage family Easter gathering. Chris Stiegel, my colleague on AM 990, The Answer in Philadelphia, turned to former U.S. Attorney Andrew McCarthy.
You wrote a piece at National Review, Authoritarian Overreach is Unnecessary to Fight the Pandemic. I, of course, want to talk to you about the DOJ and Steele dossier and all that. But this is an important thing you know a lot about from a federal law enforcement perspective. And, you know, Bill Barr has even said, like, we're going to take a look at churches not being allowed to hold worship if they don't want to. We're going to take a look at this stuff. So I'm curious, as you look at it from a 30,000-foot federal constitutional issue, when we hear Delaware, for instance, is pulling people over if they have out-of-state plates, or when we see guys being pulled off city buses in Philadelphia because they don't have masks. And we could go down the list of things that we're hearing. The Kentucky governor saying we're going to take pictures of people's license plates if they're pulling into churches. Does this give you pause as a constitutional scholar and lawman?
It does give me pause, Chris, although I think that the legal part of it is secondary, which was the point that I tried to make in a column over the weekend. The first order issue is that, we're a political community and the police and the public officials work for us, not the other way around. And it's simply a fact that if you took every federal, state, and local government and all of its police officials and you put them all together, they could not conceivably enforce shelter in place and social distancing restrictions against 330 million Americans. So what they need is cooperation and political buy-in from people. And the way to get it is not by acting like a bunch of authoritarian maniacs. So I think this is about as foolish and ill-conceived a policy, aside from the fact that a lot of it is constitutionally, I think, way overboard, because we're talking about people's fundamental rights and the way the Supreme Court interprets that, you have to use the minimal restriction that you can use that allows the government to to pursue whatever its legitimate aim is or legitimate purpose in the situation, but still respect the fundamental rights of people, which they are clearly not doing. But I think that's secondary to the fact that this has become, and these governments are becoming, politically illegitimate by these kind of activities.
Yeah, and Andy, I think it was you. If it wasn't, I'll give you credit anyway, because it sounds like something you'd say. Someone said that some of these things that officers have either been asked to do or are doing, it's their job to stand up and say, no, part of my job is to enforce constitutional law, and this is clearly not constitutional. I refuse to engage in this behavior, which could lead them to getting fired. I mean, nobody wants to lose their job, but I mean, was that you? I'm attributing that to you, that sometimes a cop has to say, no, I'm not doing that.
That wasn't me, although I would say this, Chris. They have to carry out lawful orders, and you can't maintain, as you know, you can't maintain military discipline, you can't maintain discipline in the police force if every officer becomes a law unto himself and gets to weigh, whether the orders he's been given, not only whether they're smart, but whether they're legal. So I'm willing to give the cops themselves who are getting these orders a little bit of wiggle room, although there is a certain point. It's hard to – you can't identify it, I don't think, with an articulable test. It's kind of common sense under the circumstances. But there is a point where if they're asked to do something that's blatantly illegal and immoral, they have to resist doing that, and they should resist doing it. It puts them in a very hard spot. But I don't think it's their call to make whether they're conducting themselves in a way that deprives the government of political legitimacy. I think that's above their pay grade. But in terms of being asked to do things that are blatantly unconstitutional or illegal, sure, the cop on the street has to say no.
It's so strange. I was talking to my wife about, going back, when we could go back to Missouri to visit my parents, for instance, right? And take the grandkids to see the grandparents. When would that be okay? When would that be safe? And then we started having this bizarre conversation that kind of sent chills down my spine. Well, I don't know. If we'd cross through this state or drive through that state, I'm not even sure. What, Pennsylvania plates? What if we're parked in Ohio overnight and we... I mean, what a weird... Andy, that's Orwellian, yeah. That conversation.
I'm glad you bring that up, Chris, because what the Supreme Court says is that the right to travel between states for American citizens is fundamental, constitutional, and almost beyond restriction.
Coming up.
Naturally, bat coronaviruses are normally not human transmittable. You need a species in between to have them jump to humans. China came out and said it was the pangolin. The journal Nature came out and said that was actually false. The data they provided did not show that whatsoever. And so it appears they lied to us.
A filmmaker captures the great deception. The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADEA, Alliance Defending Freedom. The Wuhan coronavirus connection is an undisputed fact, yet it remains a story largely ignored by our elite media outlets. New evidence is surfacing about the Communist Chinese Party's culpability in letting the virus spread around the world. My Salem colleague Sebastian Gorka recently interviewed Josh Phillip, an investigative reporter for the Epoch Times and part of a recent film project in China. We'll start with an audio clip from the film.
The real disease here is communism.
A sprawling and aggressive disinformation campaign unleashed globally by the Chinese Communist Party. The propaganda push, which has escalated in recent weeks, aims primarily to deflect blame over the Chinese regime's botched handling of the Wuhan coronavirus. To sow discord internationally, well-known scientists who once suggested a laboratory origin of the virus declined to be interviewed one after another. I felt as if a giant net of censorship was cast by the CCP over virologists around the world.
First things first, Joshua, how long did this take to make? Because this is really a remarkable film.
It took about 2.5 to 3 months, somewhere in there. We knew it was something that was worthwhile looking into.
Tell us what really happened in China. What surprised you the most as the person who was on camera, who was investigating this for the Epoch Times?
I think what surprised me the most was the fact that the rest of the world right now does not seem that interested in looking into where this virus actually came from. The Chinese Communist Party, it appears, lied to us about the wet market origin. They lied to us about the intermediary species. And when you're dealing with a virus like this, you need to know what the intermediary species is so you know that infections are not continuing from that animal. You know, a documentary is meant to look into this, collect all this information, and present the world with a package of data that they can take themselves and draw their own conclusions on.
And the intermediary species, the one that was key, was, of course, the bats and the SARS-like virus that the bats were suffering, correct?
Well, naturally, bat coronaviruses are normally not human transmittable. You need a species in between to have them jump to humans. China came out and said it was the pangolin. The journal Nature came out and said that was actually false. The data they provided did not show that whatsoever. And so it appears they lied to us. One interesting thing that we did find that laboratory in China, one of the bats they had collected. So the woman who ran that whole thing, Dr. Shi, was the top bat coronavirus researcher in the world. She was famous for it. Just so happened to be working at that lab in Wuhan. She was going around to different bat caves in every corner of the world and collecting these viruses. She was famous for it. And one of the things she was particularly famous for was finding the key that would allow these bat coronaviruses to infect humans.
And the key, by key, you mean there's this outer shell, there's an element of the virus which is essential in terms of its capacity to penetrate into human cells, correct?
Correct. That is the spike protein, the little mushroom-looking thing that's coming out of it.
Explain to us why you call it the CCP virus. Why Epoch Times calls it the CCP virus?
Because the Chinese Communist Party should not be equated with the Chinese people. The Chinese Communist Party's handling of this, it's lying to the CDC, and the CDC repeating that. It's lying to the WHO, and the WHO repeating that. This is what led to this virus spreading to such a terrible degree and left so many countries unprepared.
This UN agency, the World Health Organization, what is their culpability in all of this?
The WHO has been repeating every single step of the way the narratives of the Chinese Communist Party, including their lies on top of lies, and they seem to still not be questioning the validity of the information coming out, even when they do know that we've been lied to. And this is raising some serious questions about why are they repeating the Chinese Communist Party's lies, even when they've been debunked, and what is their relationship to China?
News of the mysterious COVID virus began to surface in the West late in 2019. While American media paid little attention to it, they did take a lot of time to criticize the president for cutting off travel to and from China at the end of January. But as recently reported in a Washington Post column, cables from the embassy in the United States had been warning about Wuhan's research labs 2 years ago. Senator Tom Cotton joined me to discuss the report in the Washington Post about those cables and about those labs. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I read Josh Rogan's column in the Washington Post about the bat studies at the Wuhan virology lab, and now I want a flamethrower to be dispatched to Yunnan and to the caves there. But the more important issue is, do you think the Chinese accidentally released this virus on the world as a consequence of these bits of evidence we're seeing?
So to orient all your listeners, Hugh, Josh reports on the existence of cables from our embassy in China from 2018, more than 2 years ago, about alarming safety concerns at both the laboratories in Wuhan. But of course, when coronaviruses like the SARS coronavirus or like this coronavirus are so contagious and can be so deadly, the highest safety practices are needed. And apparently some of our personnel in the Chinese embassy, when they visited the labs in Wuhan, were alarmed at the shoddy safety practices. Now, as I've said, going back to early February, we don't know the origins of this virus. We do know the Chinese Communist Party lied about it originating in that so-called food or wet market. It's only responsible, especially in light of this reporting, that we examine the possibility it originated in those laboratories. Now, again, that doesn't mean that it's man-made or engineered or that it was a bioweapon. It could be simply something as simple as shoddy construction or operational practices or just poor practice among the employees there. Someone got infected and walked out, or they disposed of the animals on which they were experimenting in an unsafe way. The Chinese Communist Party owes it to the world to be upfront and transparent about what was happening in those labs so we can understand more about this virus if it, in fact, originated from those labs.
There are similar concerns about the nearby Wuhan Center for Disease Control and Prevention Lab, which is a biosecurity level 2 lab. It leaves the impression that perhaps, as we have learned about Chinese manufacturing of PPE, they just don't have our standards, and they ought not to be entrusted with making our stuff or doing this kind of research.
China has a history of bad laboratory construction and practices. In 2004, after the SARS epidemic subsided, the SARS coronavirus escaped from one of their labs. These scientists at our embassy in Beijing obviously were worried about practices there going back as far as 2 years ago. And surely the Chinese officials knew about these concerns as well, yet they apparently did not do much to try to remedy them. And in fact, now they're engaged in a campaign to disappear anyone with any knowledge about what's happening in Wuhan or at these laboratories, or to suppress any kind of research or information about the origins of this virus.
It's so obvious. I got to close quickly by playing for you cut number 11 from yesterday's press conference, Paula Reid and Anthony Fauci. Cut number 11.
Are you doing this voluntarily, or did
no,
the president?
No, I'm doing it. Everything I do is voluntarily, please. Don't even imply that.
You know, Senator Cotton, the blue bubble is a hell of a drug. Every day the president has a press conference. Never does President Xi have a press conference. The general secretary of the Communist Party never comes out and talks to people. What is wrong with the blue bubble media?
Yeah, I think that's a well-taken point, Hugh, is that Donald Trump is speaking transparently every day directly to the press, and Chairman Xi never does, and everything he says is disinformation. I think so many of the media in Washington are so deranged by their hatred of Donald Trump that every bit of news is spun as anti-Trump news in one way or another.
Coming up.
When you look at the science, it's not really that debatable. When you look at a drug to see if you should use it, you look for two things. Is it safe and does it work?
A doctor speaks up about hydroxychloroquine when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The medical community has shown muted enthusiasm for a drug that early on was reported to have successfully treated coronavirus victims. Hydroxychloroquine has been around for over 60 years, and it's said to be cheap and plentiful. We hear about drugs in development taking months for approval, but not so much about this one. My friend and colleague Dennis Prager wanted to undo the mystery surrounding the, quote, off-label use of this drug to treat the virus. He invited an ER doctor, Dr. Simone Gold, on his program to discuss this drug.
We'll begin with the question of hydroxychloroquine. Do you prescribe it to those with COVID-19?
I do. So I have found the whole hydroxychloroquine discussion absolutely baffling. You know, I've been watching the COVID-19 since it first emerged. And really, if somebody had said to the American people 6 weeks ago or 8 weeks ago that there's a medication that's widely available, cheap, can be scaled rapidly, has been FDA approved for 65 years, has had tens, if not hundreds of millions of usages, if we could have that for COVID-19, I think everybody would have jumped on that bandwagon. And so it's shocking to see what's happened, how politicized it's become.
How have the results been with patients with COVID-19?
So I had heard that patients got better very quickly, which I found very curious because in most of infectious diseases, it's not that rapid. But then I saw it for myself. I've had many inpatients, but I've had a couple of outpatients, meaning people who came to the emergency department who then could be discharged. And I've done that twice. because our hospital doesn't want us to really do that for the outpatients. Both of them had the exact same thing I'd heard on other media, which is both of them got rapidly quicker, improved within about 12 hours.
Who, and they were positive, obviously.
Confirmed positive.
Right. Now,
the only reason I was able to do that is because we got the testing that you could get it done in an hour. Prior to that, I couldn't have done it so quickly.
What about people in more advanced stages of the disease in a hospital? Are they being prescribed it by you or anyone else?
Yes. Yeah, so that changed. I have always been a fan of a hydroxychloroquine, partly because, you know, there is no other specific treatment, and partly just the mechanism of the drug seems like it's likely to be effective. But our hospital didn't, like many hospitals, most hospitals, was not using it for inpatient until about 2 weeks ago, I think is about when we changed, and then all of a sudden we changed. Now we use it.
Why the change 2 weeks ago?
So I think that's a great question, you know, and it's just to remind the listeners that at some point there comes enough pressure or enough decision makers all agree to change something, because I was an advocate for it, but I would say that I was pretty alone in that. And I wasn't involved in the reason why the hospital changed, but, you know, I came to work one day, now all of a sudden we were doing it. And there really is no more, I don't think that evidence changed from a Monday to a Tuesday, but at one point we just decided to do it. I was not privy to why.
But nobody gave you a reason?
May I say something else about that?
Sure.
That's interesting about that?
Yeah.
So one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you is when that change came about, you know, I kind of rolled my eyes. I'm like, really? What was so different from last week? But okay. Then when I started prescribing for outpatients, mostly because I had the confirmed test right there in the ER, I was given a lot of pushback about prescribing for outpatients. And one of the reasons I was given pushback is it, quote unquote, wasn't indicated. And I said, well, it's not indicated for inpatients either. You know, we just decided that it was, and so now we're doing it. And I said, in 2 weeks from now, you'll tell me that it is indicated, but, you know, just come back and say to me, good job. So it's a bit of a moving target. I'm not picking on any one hospital individually, but I do find it concerning as a physician how physicians have become so politicized without themselves really how politicized.
So much for the notion that scientists only care about science.
So I'll tell you what's been really demoralizing about this whole episode that I've never seen in my career is I've talked to so many physicians who I know on other levels, and I believe that they don't even see that they're politicized. And that's been very distressing to me, because I think when you look at the science, it's not really that debatable. When you look at a drug to see if you should use it, you look for two things. Is it safe and does it work? That's it. Safety,
right.
And efficacy and
yes.
Discussion.
Are you alone in your thinking in your hospital among your colleagues?
Okay, so this is a good story. I'm not alone. I would say I'm in the minority. I don't know what it would be like in a different part of the country, but I will tell you that two doctors have come to me to get the COVID test. Both of them said they would absolutely take it. They were upset the test was negative because they wanted to start the medicine. They both had the medicine, and they both wanted to start the medicine. So, you know, I think what people say publicly and maybe what they do privately might be different.
Coming up.
I also talk about practical duty and the need to get the small things right every single day.
Fortitude from the perspective of a war veteran, and not just any war veteran, a SEAL you've seen on Saturday Night Live. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Dan Crenshaw is a bright freshman congressman from Greater Houston. He's out with a new book, the title Fortitude. American Resilience in the Era of American Outrage. He's a Navy SEAL veteran, distinguished by that eye patch I mentioned, and he was a guest this week on my program. I want to begin by talking about Susan Carol Crenshaw, if you do not mind. Page 72. Going from kindergarten to fourth grade, knowing that your mother is dying, that the center of a small boy's world is collapsing, is an experience I wouldn't wish on anyone, But from this grief came learning. I got to experience the nature of a true hero, and the example she set was the most powerful, fortifying, and selfless thing I've ever seen, including in combat. Lying helpless in a hospital bed, I had to wonder whether my mother had asked the same desperate question I was currently asking. Would I ever see my family again? I figured that if she could suffer through that question and the unknowable answer, so could I. My mother spent a half decade staring death in the face, burdened with caring for two small boys whom she would not live to see grow up. She lived day to day in ever-increasing pain. The cancer afflicted her, and the cancer treatments afflicted her, too. 6 rounds of chemotherapy on top of radiation treatments are a brutal experience for even the strongest constitution. Self-pity is never a useful state, but if anyone had a reason to feel sorry for herself, it was her, and she never complained. Wow, Dan Crenshaw, that's remarkable.
Yeah, she was. And, you know, she eventually lost that battle. And the point I'm making there, it's not just to tell my story, but the point I'm making is that in the worst of situations, you can tell yourself, and objectively speaking, that somebody else does have it worse than you. You can draw upon the strength of others and their overcoming of adversity to overcome your own adversity. And, in a lighter way, we say this, and it's not that much lighter, but in SEAL training, when you're suffering and you're cold and you're tired, and the instructors often remind you, this is actually one of the more motivating things they say. Usually they're just saying things that are the opposite, but they say thousands and thousands have made it before you, so can you. And it's just a reminder. It's just a reminder that you're not the only one who has had it bad. And then you have to ask yourself, what kind of person do you want to be? Do you want to be, since so many people have had it bad and some have overcome it and some have it, which one do you want to be? And it's a tough love question. And in our society too often now, we're tempted to ask about your victimhood. We're tempted to elevate that victimhood and almost celebrate it. And while that at first feels compassionate, it's exactly the opposite because it removes power from the individual.
Congressman Crenshaw, this is actually a book about suffering. And that's what surprised me about it. It's about resilience and mental toughness and battling the outrage culture. That's a direct quote. And on the variety of tactics and strategies one can have that, but it really is on the redemptive qualities of suffering and on the objective assessment of your situation vis-a-vis the world. I don't know, of course you did not time it for a pandemic, but I don't know that there's any book better suited to a pandemic because the world's on the rack, right?
Right, and on the one hand, it's a terrible time to come out with a book, especially as a politician. But on the other hand, I'm very proud of the lessons that are in here and how incredibly useful they are for people right now. The book was written in response to petty outrage culture, things you really shouldn't be angry about, but you are. Response to the media's malfeasance and microaggressions on college campuses. That was originally the outrage culture that I was trying to identify and then find solutions to. But these solutions are clearly applicable to actual, real hardship as well. And I talk about, especially towards the end, talk about the stories that we have to tell ourselves to overcome hardship and suffering. In previous chapters, I talk about the need to confront it and to even seek it out, self-imposed suffering. And by that, very simply, I mean challenge yourself with hard things on a daily basis. Maybe that's going to the gym. Maybe that's sleeping outside every once in a while. Maybe it's finishing a project you just have been putting off for a long time. But we've gotten away from challenging ourselves, and we've become too comfortable with comfort. And so I am proud of the lessons in here. I think they'll speak to people in a much deeper way. It's not your typical SEAL book, and it's not your typical politician book.
It's got nothing to do with either. In fact, I thought fortitude, I didn't know what to think. I know you work with Keith Urban, who along with Bob Barnett are the best agents in Washington, D.C. And I knew that you would sell a lot of books because you are who you are and people know your story. But I did not expect to find, for example, on page 451, recall St. John Paul II. We have liberty not to do as we wish, but to do as we ought. I don't think you're a Catholic. I am. And I'm saying to myself, what in the world is John Paul II doing in Dan Crenshaw's book?
Well, no, I'm not Catholic. I was married in a Catholic church, though, because my wife is Catholic. So, you know, I've got a foot in the door there. But now the quote is in there for just very practical reasons, because it's such a perfect quote. It's such a perfect quote for the message I was trying to get across here, and to the message I often deliver about ordered liberty versus unbridled freedom. And what St. John Paul was saying there was, we have freedom in this country, not because we're supposed to do whatever we want, but because we are supposed to do what we ought to do. And then we have to answer the question of, well, what should you ought to do? And there's a moral truth that we live by in this country. It's what we were founded on, this Judeo-Christian history, where even in the House of Representatives, the portrait of Moses looks down on the Speaker of the House and reminds us that our laws are derived from just and absolute truths, you know, the Ten Commandments. And it's a much deeper way of thinking about what is right and wrong, how we should follow that path, and how to feel shame when we veer away from it. I have an entire chapter on what it means to feel shame properly, and then a sense of duty to do the right thing. And then the next chapter is about a sense of duty, which is also highly applicable to now, because I also talk about practical duty and the need to get the small things right every single day, no matter how small that mission is. It is part of a bigger mission.
Coming up, the need for inspiring stories.
During this pandemic, when you see, you know, the battle gets thicker and thicker and the good becomes clearer and the evil becomes clearer, we can see people trying to use this time. It's like the burning of the Reichstag. We are going to seize more government power. We're going to take away freedom. And it's all in the name of something. You know, it's always some good reason.
Author Eric McTaxis for the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt in a moment. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, hear from a New York pastor who fought coronavirus.
I had every symptom and was in a very dark place.
And the weighty challenges on those organizations serving the poor.
We're seeing a great increase in the number of people that are coming to the rescue mission in great need.
The fast emerging threats to religious liberty.
Government officials cannot single out people of faith and treat them differently than they would anyone else in the community.
And lessons from the pandemic response in the past.
Our founding fathers dealt with quarantines all the time. Yellow fever, malaria were something they lived with on a summer-to-summer basis.
All this and more. Be sure to join us and visit our website at ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. You hear it all the time, especially now. This pandemic is not all that bad. That's because many of us are looking for ways to be strong and courageous for our neighbors and our families and our country and our friends. Eric McTaxis is my friend, a distinguished author of biography, Stories of Strong and Courageous People. He's also a host and a fellow colleague on the Salem Radio Network. Eric joined Dennis Prager talking about his new book, Seven More Men.
We need inspiring stories. This is critical. It's critical at any time. This was the diet of young Americans.
Yes.
In the past, and now all you read about is they all stink. They were all racist. That's America. This is not just about Americans, because it's got Solzhenitsyn, for example. But and he writes extremely interestingly. Seven More Men. Sit down and, you know, read it to your kids or grandchildren. But just read it for yourself. Anyway, I just wanted you to know it's a terrific thing.
It's not meant. It's not really a book that I wrote just for young people.
No, it isn't.
Really, it's just a regular book for everybody.
Yes.
But my hope in writing it, well, in writing all these books, I wrote a book called Seven Men, a book called Seven Women. Now, the new one, which is out today or tomorrow, I forget, it's called Seven More Men, and then a year from now, Seven More Women. These are the stories of heroes. And just as you said, Dennis, we need heroes desperately. Why? Because the culture, the secular culture, is giving us anti-heroes And then it's giving us, you know, what we today could call fake heroes, these people that they lift up. And in the past, we would have thought, what? Are you kidding? Why should I admire Colin Kaepernick or, you know, Beyonce or whoever they're
Colin,
putting out
that's
there?
That's such a good point.
You know, it's like ridiculous. So we need real heroes.
Right.
But the thing is, you know, a year ago, I would have said now more than ever. But during this pandemic, when you see, you know, the battle gets thicker and thicker and the good becomes clearer and the evil becomes clearer. We can see people trying to use this time. It's like the burning of the Reichstag. We are going to seize more government power. We're going to take away freedom. And it's all in the name of something. You know, it's always some good reason. And Americans need to be reminded that through history, and this is not everybody in my book, Seven More Men or Seven Men or Seven Women, but people stood up against this kind of thing. And we now, when you read it, you are inspired similarly to stand up. When you read the story of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, oh my goodness. I mean, and the other reason, you know, that I wrote these books, it's a chapter to each man, okay? So you don't have to read a whole book. A lot of people said, oh, I'm not going to read a 300-page book on Wilberforce or a 500-page book on Martin Luther or a 600-page book on Bonhoeffer. I said, you know what? You need to know these stories. So I'm going to boil them down to a fraction of that, and I'm going to give you seven of them.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.